Welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. I am your host, Jonathan. Accept no cheap imitations. I've received a few emails and DMs since I started this show a few months ago, asking if I'm ever going to cover the JFK assassination. After all, some theories do point to JFK as the one who was threatening full disclosure on our dealings with extraterrestrials going back to the Eisenhower administration. And that would have made public a lot of secret machinations at very top levels of the government. While I'm not ruling out the possibility that I might do that at some point in the far-flung future, it's not something I'm keen on doing right now. It's not hard to find a JFK conspiracy that fits your own beliefs while contradicting everyone else's. And living in New Orleans, where Lee Harvey Oswald spent some time in 1963, it's nearly impossible to spend any amount of time in a bar before you hear at least two theories about how things really happened. Which is exactly how I learned about the subject of tonight's episode. And probably at least one other episode, depending on how much ground I can cover tonight. See, a few years back, I was at a bar here in New Orleans, specifically Lucky's Bar and Grill and Laundromat, and it was getting late on a Friday night. One of the other regulars, beside myself, started talking about conspiracies, and he asked me if I knew about the one about Dr. Ochsner and Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, I was intrigued. Dr. Ochsner and what is now the Ochsner Medical Center are both held in fairly high regard in New Orleans, and a local spin on what is usually a globally encompassing conspiracy regarding Oswald and the JFK assassination was something new. I needed to hear more. The story I was told was that a young doctor was working with Dr. Ochsner and Oswald on a biological weapon at the behest of the U.S. government in an underground lab here in New Orleans. This biological weapon got out of control, and the young doctor was murdered, but not in a conventional manner. When her body was found, one of the arms was completely disintegrated and looked like she had been shot with some sort of energy weapon. I was advised to look into the topic in more detail, and then the conversation turned to how energy weapons would not have been possible in the early 60s without a transistor, which we all know was recovered from an extraterrestrial craft and certainly not invented by extremely smart human beings. So I sat on this conspiracy for a few years. The one time I tried to look into it, I found a book that had a foreword by Jim Mars, which of course immediately sent up a red flag in my head. For those unfamiliar with Jim Mars, he's probably best known for his book Crossfire, which was the source for Oliver Stone's movie JFK. Later in life, Mars transitioned from JFK conspiracies to 9/11 conspiracies, as well as dabbling in UFOs with books such as Our Occulted History, Do the Global Elite Conceal Ancient Aliens?, and documentaries such as Fastwalkers and Ancient Aliens and the New World Order. So, depending on one's opinion of Jim Mars, he was either a truth seeker, a disinformation agent like the kind Bill Cooper talked about when he was burning his bridges with MUFON, or Jim Mars is a very niche entertainer. I'll leave that for you to decide. But every place I looked for information on this conspiracy involving Ochsner Oswald and the murdered physician kept pointing me to this one book, as if it was the only exhaustive source on the subject. So I gave in and read it. That book is titled Dr. Mary's Monkey by Ed Haslam, who was a former aide to Professor Longhair, a former marketing executive, and is now an author and recurring guest on Coast to Coast whenever JFK conspiracy theories, the truth about JFK, is discussed. On a side note, Ed Haslam also seemed to have had a busted L key on his keyboard when he wrote his book, because a lot of his sentences don't make sense, even for a conspiracy theorist. And at least one sentence became extremely problematic to read because of the missing L key when he discussed Nazis marching for the glory of their flag. His publisher should have caught that, and when I say publisher, I mean Ed Haslam, because we all know that major publishers are too scared to get close to the truth. And yes, someone is going to point out that Ed Haslam's books are currently being put out by a publisher that sells books on JFK, 9/11, and the deep state conspiracies. But his book has been sold for years, with missing L's all over the place. So they might want to think about a new edition. They might also want to think about updating the book for the purposes of the COVID-19 pandemic. Not because there are any L's in COVID or coronavirus, which there aren't, but because it dovetails nicely with the larger arc of this story, as we'll find out. Let me tell you, that bar conversation I had about this topic, it completely understated how wild and deep this conspiracy theory is. So, without further delay, let's actually get into tonight's topic, which opens with a murder. On June 21st, 1964, at approximately 4:30 in the morning, Dr. Mary Sherman was found dead in her apartment on St. Charles Avenue. Neighbors were alerted by the smell of smoke coming from her apartment, and when the police arrived, they found Dr. Sherman's body on the floor of her apartment, smoldering and covered in clothes. Portions of the right side of her body and the whole of her right arm had been disintegrated, presumably by the fire, as two matchsticks were found on the cedar chest in her room. This is one hell of a murder scene, and it made the headlines in the local papers immediately and for weeks afterward. But to understand why the loss of Dr. Mary Sherman had such an impact on the city of New Orleans, we need to understand who she was. Mary Sherman was born in Evanston, Illinois in 1913. She was, by all accounts, a stellar student and ended up doing graduate work at the University of Chicago. Mary Sherman performed groundbreaking work in nuclear, biochemical, and genetic research and was so ahead of the curve that her papers were cited well into the 1980s and 90s. Her work in cancer research attracted the attention of one Dr. Alton Ochsner, who was the chief of surgery at Tulane Medical School, in addition to being president of the American Cancer Society. He offered her a position as a partner at Tulane, and she moved to New Orleans in 1952. From there, Mary Sherman became the chairman of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. She was an internationally known bone specialist who focused on bone cancer treatment and research. That's the professional Dr. Mary Sherman who was loved by the people of New Orleans. The private Mary Sherman loved to hang out with the artists and theater actors in the French Quarter. But even in her personal life, there was nothing out of the ordinary for anyone in love with all that New Orleans had to offer. So why would anyone want to cause Dr. Mary Sherman any harm? Before we get to that, let's look at the coroner's report. A preliminary examination by the doctor on the scene determined that there were several possible stab wounds of the left arm of the body, which had not been deteriorated by the fire. There also appeared to be several stab wounds in the torso. There was also a large wound of the inside of the right thigh just above the knee. From further examination of the body, it was noted by the coroner that the right arm and a portion of the right side of the body extending from the right hip to the right shoulder was completely burned away, exposing various vital organs. The crime report didn't offer up many clues either. It read, "The apartment was composed of a living room, kitchen, bathroom, study, and bedroom. Located in the bedroom was the body of a white female, apparently dead, later learned to be Dr. Mary Sherman. White female, 51 years old. The body was in a supine position, the head in the direction of the river, the feet in the direction of the lake, and both legs were outstretched and parallel to each other. The left arm was outstretched and parallel to the left side of the body. The right side of the body, from waist to where the right shoulder would be, including the whole right arm, was apparently disintegrated from the fire, yielding the inside organs of the body. There was what appeared to be a stab wound in the left arm, and also the inner right leg near the knee. The body was nude. However, there was clothing which had apparently been placed on top of the body, mostly covering the body from just above the pubic area to the neck. Some of the mentioned clothes had been burned completely, while others were still intact, but scorched. It appeared that no scuffle took place inside of said bedroom or throughout the apartment. Those are the official statements. Other details that should be mentioned are that the burglar alarm in the apartment was switched to the off position. Dr. Mary Sherman's car was parked about 8 blocks away from her apartment, and the key to the ignition was found tossed over a wall. Her wallet and purse were empty, but the easily accessible jewelry box in her apartment was left untouched. The more details that came out after the reports, the more questions they raised. Even a later report from a pathologist in the coroner's office made Dr. Sherman's death more mysterious. The most interesting things in that pathologist's report were: 1. The victim was dead before the body was stabbed. 2. Dr. Sherman was dead prior to the fire in her apartment. 3. A good portion of the clothes found on the victim's body were neatly folded. And 4. Those clothes were mostly made out of synthetic materials and would only ignite at temperatures of 500 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. They would have only smoldered at lower temperatures. Even Mary's downstairs neighbor, who was used to hearing Dr. Sherman come in from work late at night, told the police she did not hear Mary come home that night, nor any sounds of a struggle, which tracked with the police reports that stated there were no signs of forced entry through the door or window. So, up to this point, we have the very accomplished Dr. Mary Sherman, who met an untimely but very strange death in her apartment. The circumstances under which the murder took place are unknown, and as the weeks and months dragged on, the New Orleans police couldn't turn up anything. The FBI was called in, but a memo came down from J. Edgar Hoover's office, ordering his agents not to investigate the murder of Mary Sherman. This could be because Hoover felt that this murder was a waste of the FBI's resources, or it could point to something bigger. I mean, if the police were hitting dead ends regarding the murder of a fairly high-profile person such as Dr. Sherman, why wouldn't a federal agency take interest? Sure, she wasn't a Rockefeller, but a death this mysterious would certainly require more resources than the NOPD had at their disposal. But the FBI stood down. As a murder alone, this is a pretty wild story. And were it not connected, however tenuously, to other topics, I might include the death of Dr. Sherman in an episode about spontaneous human combustion. And after everything you have heard up to this point, along with the trailer I put up last week, you might have at least one lingering question. That being, if this murder took place in July of 1964, nearly a full year after the JFK assassination, how the hell are the two connected? To answer that, we have to go back to the October 1967 issue of Playboy. And yes, people do read it for the articles. This particular issue had a lengthy interview with Jim Garrison. For those who may not know, Garrison was the DA in New Orleans, and he had his own theories on the JFK assassination, and was later played by Kevin Costner in the Oliver Stone film. I'm not going to get into everything Garrison did regarding the Zapruder film, his theory of two Oswalds, neither of whom, by the way, was a talking rabbit, or any of the other stuff. However, this one excerpt from the Playboy interview stands out in relation to tonight's topic. Playboy. You know, Penn Jones, Norman Mailer, and others have charged that Jack Ruby was injected with live cancer cells in order to silence him. Do you agree? Garrison, I can't agree or disagree, since I have no evidence one way or the other. But we have discovered that David Ferry had a rather curious hobby in addition to his study of cartridge trajectories. Cancer research. He filled his apartment with white mice. At one point, he had almost 2,000, and the neighbors complained. Wrote a medical treatise on the subject, and worked with a number of New Orleans doctors on means of inducing cancer in mice. After the assassination, one of these physicians, Dr. Mary Sherman, was found hacked to death with a kitchen knife in her New Orleans apartment. Her murder is listed as unsolved. Ferry's experiments may have been purely theoretical, and Dr. Sherman's death completely unrelated to her association with Ferry, but I do find it interesting that Jack Ruby died of cancer a few weeks after his conviction for murder had been overruled in appeals court, and he was ordered to stand trial in Dallas, thus allowing him to speak freely if he so desired. I would also note that there was little hesitancy in killing Lee Harvey Oswald in order to prevent him from talking, so there is no reason to suspect that any more considerations would have been shown to Jack Ruby if he had posed a threat to the architects of the conspiracy. And that ends the excerpt of the Playboy interview with Jim Garrison. Now, let's consider what Garrison is asserting. If we allow ourselves to overlook the fact that he got the details of Dr. Mary Sherman's death wrong, one almost wonders why Garrison was replaced with Harry Connick Sr. as district attorney, he is alleging that Dr. Sherman and David Ferry worked together on some sort of secret cancer project. And with that, we have a new piece to the puzzle, David Ferry. I'll give you an idea who David Ferry was after these messages.
Hello! Dr. Pinkerton of the Consortium of Genius here, ensconced within my secret lab. At long last, the time has come to reveal my master plan. While you have all been preoccupied with that insipid but popular virus making the rounds, I have been readying my laboratory for a bold new test. The evaluation and elimination of my sonic competition for world takeover! Yes, ladies and gentlemen, every week I shall be capturing a different band here in the secret lab and subjecting them to hideous, hard-rocking experimentation live! Friday night at 8 p.m. Be here to see what fate befalls the unwary. And find out if they can escape from the secret lab!
That's Escape from the Secret Lab every Friday night at 8 p.m. Central. Watch to see great music performers and a chance to win prizes. It's the best live streaming show out there where the audience decides the outcome. Check it out on escapefromthesecretlab.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. So who was David Ferry, and what was his connection to Dr. Mary Sherman? Well, if you've seen Oliver Stone's movie JFK, you may remember David Ferry as the guy who had the painted-on eyebrows and who was played by Joe Pesci. While the physical portrayal wasn't entirely inaccurate, that movie didn't actually tell anyone who David Ferry really was. David Ferry was a pilot who did not really hide his special brand of ultra-conservative patriotism, even though he described himself as liberal on civil rights issues. I am not going to get into David Ferry's love life. While the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey seems to make a big deal of it, either as filler or because he thought it had some bearing on the story, I do not. However, David Ferry's political views certainly play a role in this story. David Ferry hated communists. He despised Russia, which would have made him a bad conservative Republican by today's standards. And he really disliked Fidel Castro. Though it should be noted, he supported the idea of Castro overthrowing Batista, maybe because he liked baseball, I don't know. But quickly became a rabid anti-Castro activist in the early 60s. You see, many people who fled Cuba for political reasons ended up in New Orleans around that time. The rumor was that David Ferry was working with these Cuban exiles to find a way to overthrow or at least destabilize Castro's regime. It is from David Ferry's anti-Castro beliefs, along with the excerpt before from the Playboy interview with Garrison, that the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, Ed Haslam, posits the theory that David Ferry, with the aid of Mary Sherman, along with the approval of Alton Ochsner and the U.S. government, developed a secret project to create cancer in a lab and inject it into Castro to thwart communism in the Western Hemisphere. Let's pause for a second and think about the state of science in the early 60s, specifically in New Orleans. Now, cancer research had come quite some way in the 20th century thanks to people like Dr. Mary Sherman, who, as you may remember, specialized in bone cancer. Dr. Alton Ochsner was also familiar with cancer. Apart from being one of the first physicians to warn that cigarettes caused cancer after tracking smokers for decades following World War I, Ochsner was intimately familiar with vaccines. You see, the first round of polio vaccines in the United States in 1955 didn't have a 100% success rate. In fact, it killed and or paralyzed some children. Bringing it closer to home, the first round of polio vaccines killed Dr. Ochsner's grandson and paralyzed his granddaughter. See, let it never be said that I left anti-vaxxers out in the cold. This one's for you and all you do, or rather, all you don't do. Ed Haslam's book leans heavily in your direction, so take heart in knowing that he and his theories may be on your side, if he ever actually commits to an opinion on anything. Now, the reason a portion of the first batch of polio vaccines was bad had to do with how it was made. Rhesus monkey kidney cells were used to prepare the vaccine, which in itself is not unusual. However, a certain portion of the vaccines were found to contain simian virus 40, or SV40 for short. SV40 is a DNA virus found in both monkeys and humans, and also has the potential to cause tumors in animals. Between 1955 and 1963, there's that magical year again, roughly 90% of children and 60% of adults were injected with polio vaccinations that were contaminated with SV40. Fast forward to 2004, and the National Cancer Institute announced that SV40 does cause cancer in some animal models. However, SV40 likely does not cause cancer in humans. Likely does not. I want you to shelve that last sentence for a bit, because it plays no part in what we're discussing right now. That's right, I want you to put facts on the back burner. Ed Haslam has no room for your so-called science and his conspiracy theory. Anyway, knowing that SV40 could cause tumors, but also knowing that monkey kidney cells could provide an excellent canvas for vaccines, it was theorized that this could be an excellent testing ground for finding a cure for cancer. Not just any one type of cancer, but all cancers. We got brain cancer, we got pancreatic cancer, we got liver cancer, we got skin cancer, wet cancer, dry cancer, all types of cancer. Well, New Orleans certainly wasn't short on monkey tissue for scientific experiments. The Delta Regional Primate Center, now known as the Tulane University National Primate Research Center, opened up in the early 60s, 1964 to be exact, if you want to tuck that year away for later on in the series. It was affectionately known as Little Yerkes, after the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta, Georgia, where they taught primates to communicate and opened up the skulls of still-living monkeys and attached computers to control their motor skills, and a whole bunch of other experiments that make people stare in horror when they see the footage. In fact, in the 1990s, a lot of the monkeys escaped and took New Orleans by storm in what honestly must have been a hilariously awesome sight. But getting a hold of cancer cells, on the other hand, was difficult, and making them in a lab was expensive. It required very sophisticated equipment. Sure, you could train a monkey to smoke cigarettes and wait for it to get cancer, but that takes too long. However, if you had access to a high-powered particle accelerator, you could mutate cells and create cancer to see which treatment worked. Now, I know what you're thinking, especially if you're from New Orleans. There isn't and has never been a particle accelerator in this city. After all, particle accelerators, from the time, were large and very conspicuous and covered a lot of ground. Even now, particle accelerators take up a lot of real estate, and the technology has advanced quite a bit from the 1960s. But what if that particle accelerator was not laid out horizontally, but rather vertically, in a tall building, shooting a high-energy beam downward at biological tissue to mutate regular cells into cancerous ones? You see, it is posited by Ed Haslam that this particle accelerator would have been located in a tall building, thereby concealing it from the public. What if those mutated cells that were exposed to the particle beam were then injected into little white mice to observe the cancer so physicians such as Dr. Mary Sherman and Dr. Ochsner could find a cure? What if they temporarily put finding a cure on hold and just focused on creating rapidly spreading cancer and other viruses? What if I left this for the next episode? Which is where we'll pick up in part two, where we'll discuss Science Gone Wrong, The Plot to Kill Castro, Lee Harvey Oswald's affair with a mad scientist who's now on the run from the law, how not to use a particle accelerator, and much, much more. And now it's time to discuss announcements. Remember, next week's episode will have a more casual tone. We'll look into some minor topics that we possibly can or cannot stretch out into full episodes, possibly some headlines in the news, and some more current events in the world of the weird and paranormal. So part two of this series will resume in 2 weeks. Also, The Mothball Prophecies has fully switched over to Anchor FM. I've made sure our feed is on as many podcasting platforms as I can think of, but if I've missed one, drop a line to mothball@crescentcitymedia.com, and I'll make sure we're on your preferred podcast listening platform. Also, if you have any scary stories, send them my way. If I get enough submissions from our listeners, I'll run a contest, and the winner will get some sweet Mothball Prophecies merchandise. Send your stories, preferably true ones if you have them, to, again, mothball@crescentcitymedia.com, subject line stories. I'll be reading these on Halloween if we get enough of them, so you have a little under a month and a half to send something in. I've got some other surprises coming together as well, but I'm keeping those to myself for the time being. Thanks, everyone, for listening to The Mothball Prophecies. Until next time, sleep tight.